which is 113055, Central State Southeast and Southwest Areas Pension Fund versus NAGI.
Good morning,
Your Honor. Good morning, Mr. Robinson.
May it please the Court. My name is Paul Robinson, and I'm representing Charles Nagy in the matter before the Court this morning. The ultimate issue was whether Mr. Nagy was operating a trade or business. If he was, then he is jointly liable for the withdrawal liability obligation. The ultimate issue gets decided after analysis of three sub-issues. Two sub-issues are related. One is an issue of law, the second an issue of fact, and it comes out of the fact pattern wherein Mr. Nagy is leasing property to the withdrawing employer.
You know, I'm very perplexed from your brief and from your start there about your focus on that leasing issue. You won that issue below.
I understand that, Your Honor.
So move on to the issue where you lost.
Okay.
You don't want to overturn the district judge's decision.
I was going to rest on the factual issue, which is the second of those two issues. I only bring up the first issue because there could be an interpretation that a recent decision of this court in Scope BP would impact the legal issue in which the judge ruled in my favor, and that is the application of the Grotzinger test.
Well, that's what my question is to you. You know, are those two tests reconcilable? In other words, does the new holding conflict with the Supreme Court's directive?
Well, I don't believe they're reconcilable under the law of this circuit. The law of this circuit was first established in Personnel, which held that the Grotzinger test was applicable, and the basis for that holding is that the way in which the two-step test was applied would conform to the common and ordinary meaning of the phrase trade or business. Almost simultaneously, I think the opinions are 18 days apart, another panel of this court in Ditello ruled that the Grotzinger test was not applicable simply because they felt that the phrase trade or business was too amorphous, that there's too many different standards in the tax code to apply it. So it rejected that test. In Fulkerson, this court looked at the test again and said, we believe that the Grotzinger test, which applies a two-step analysis, is sufficiently determinative of whether a trade or business is being conducted, and we believe that because the phrase conforms with the normal meaning of the words trade or business. The next step historically was in the White case, and in the White case, this court said there was early on in our circuit two different standards that conflicted with each other in Ditello and Personnel, and that conflict has been resolved in applying the Grotzinger test. So it recognized that there was a dispute and said it has been resolved in favor of the Grotzinger test. Keep in mind, in Personnel, there was a nexus between part of the leasing operation and the withdrawing employer. There was multiple activities being conducted by the defendant. One of them was a five-year lease directly to the withdrawing employer. If the intent of this circuit was to establish two separate but equal tests, one which would apply when there was a nexus and one which would apply when there was not, it would have and could have done so, but it specifically chose not to. In the most recent opinion, unfortunately, there is a diversion, and the court goes back and says, relying on Ditello, we find that categorically, when there is a nexus between the leasing operation and the withdrawing employer, we will impose liability. The problem with that is Ditello was rejected. So it's no longer at the point that Scoff says relying on Ditello, it's no longer law of the circuit. It was rejected in Fulkerson and reaffirmed as being rejected in White. So it strays from the law of the circuit.
So you want that recently decided case overruled?
Well, I'm not appellate counsel in that case, Your Honor. What I'm saying is...
Well, we would have to do that to find for you enough on that first issue.
I think that that recently decided case does not conform to the law that has been established in this circuit. So I don't think it would necessarily call for a reversal per se, but to the extent that it would be recognized as law of this circuit, it creates a conflict with both Fulkerson and White, and perhaps then the remedy becomes an in-bank review, if there is such a...
Why don't we just look at it as a reconciliation of all of that conflicting case law under the Grotzinger standard that leasing is in?
Well,
and what's wrong with that conclusion, even if there maybe was insufficient tracing of the chronological history of all the cases?
Well,
why shouldn't leasing be in?
The Grotzinger standard is based upon an analysis of the plain and ordinary meaning of the term or phrase trade or business. The typical analysis for statutory construction would require that you go through that process first, and only if you cannot reach an understanding of what the phrase means do you then go on and look at the legislative history. And that's the analysis the Ditello court went through. They determined that there was not a common and ordinary meaning to the phrase trade or business, so they could not use that standard of statutory analysis, and then went to the next lower standard, which is the review of the legislative history.
Well, it seems to me that, you know, the Scofic, however we say that, I hate those letters, that the holding is really just a subset of the Grotzinger test, which looks at continuity and regularity and primary purpose in determining what constitutes a trade or business. And I don't know, I certainly agree with Judge Sykes. We'd be reversing our three-month-old precedent if we agreed with you.
But if you didn't, Your Honor.
Set upon by the panel, one of whom is sitting up here with me.
Exactly.
Next to me.
I understand that, and I am treading carefully.
Which puzzles me why you're even bothering with it, because you had a favorable ruling on that aspect of your case.
Well, again,
how you could reach that in this case is just really beyond me.
Well, my concern, Your Honor, was this. Before the court goes through the process of applying the Grotzinger test under the undisputed facts of the record, it must first make a legal determination of whether the Grotzinger test is the proper test. And the court below made that legal determination and then applied the test. The scope
in doing so decided in your favor.
Right.
Are you doing here talking about it?
The Scope BP decision calls into question whether the district court's analysis of what the proper legal test was correct.
So then you'll lose on everything? What is going on?
Well, again, I'm willing to rely upon the analysis that's set forth in the briefs and in the district court's opinion on the question of the relationship between Mr. Nagy and his leasing operation.
Okay,
and
well,
then move on.
Describe how things would have looked if WFC had said to him, you've been our president for some time, but now we want to hire you to be an independent contractor and help to effectuate the sale of the business. How would the factors have looked then, ignoring the declaration as independent contractor, of course? In other words, no matter how the two parties decided to label the role would have looked the same. He would have done the same work, and he would have received the same pay, right?
I believe that that's largely correct, yes. And my concern, my overriding concern with the district court's analysis of the WVC matter is the court was presented with cross motions for summary judgment. Under the legal standard, he should give deference to Mr. Nagy while reviewing the facts as presented by Central States and then should give deference to Central States when reviewing the facts as presented by Mr. Nagy. Instead, what the court has apparently done is applied a post-trial standard to reviewing the factual record. And I think it's best illustrated by looking at the second and third prongs of the five-prong test. In each of those two analyses, the court made the determination that the facts were neutral. And I don't see how, under a summary judgment standard, the court could have determined they were neutral. They should have been favorable to my client when reviewing Central State's motion and favorable to Central State's when reviewing my client's motion. The only way it could be neutral is if the record was undeveloped. But giving the benefit of the doubt to the non-moving party, there should not be a neutral analysis.
What difference does that make in the long run here? There really isn't any evidence to support the proposition that he was an employee of the country club.
Well, and if there isn't, Your Honor, and I tend to agree with you that as the record as it was presented, there was not enough evidence to make that determination, but I believe there was not enough evidence under a summary judgment standard to make the determination in favor of Central States.
If all the evidence points in one direction, that is, that he's an independent contractor, on each of the common law factors that are determinative of that question, then you lose.
If that is the case, you are correct. I would lose. But that was not the case, Your Honor.
I thought you just told me there wasn't any evidence that he was an employee.
No. No, what I was saying, and if I said that, I apologize for misspeaking. What I was saying is the court on points 2 and 3 of the 5-point test saw evidence.
Okay, this is a de novo standard of review anyway. So just tell us what evidence there is that he was an employee.
Okay.
I thought all the evidence is on the other side of the scale, the independent contractor side of the scale, as the common law test is commonly understood.
Okay. I don't believe that that is the case, Your Honor. We'll start with the first point. First question is one of control. And I think the court misunderstood the application of that test. The test is...
Forget about what the district court did. Talk to us.
Okay. The first standard is what is the right to control. Not the exercise of actual control, but the right to control. When you're looking at the right to control, you have to look at the functions being performed by the employee in question. In this case, the employee was recognized by the court as being the chief executive officer of the company. The right to control lies solely with the board of directors. That's it. Mr. Nagy, in his affidavit, referenced that the board of directors gave him some direction. There was no contrary evidence to that representation. The court below said the record was devoid of testimony from the board of directors. So there's not an independent basis to rule that there's factors favoring the fund's determination that the control test applied negatively to Mr. Nagy. There's no testimony regarding it under the right to control.
The board hired and fired and set policy at a high level of generality. It didn't run the place. He ran the place independently of the board.
Right.
Very common.
Yes.
And that means that factor weighs in favor of an independent contractor finding. So let's go to the next one.
Okay. I'm sorry, but I do disagree, Your Honor, respectfully so, because the standard is the right to control, and a chief executive officer...
Right to control day-to-day activities, right, but not just hiring and firing.
But the chief executive officer acting in that capacity is doing what an employee would do if the employee is the chief executive officer.
He was paid as an independent contractor. That's a highly significant factor.
He was paid under 1099, yes.
He held other jobs. That's a highly significant factor here.
Okay. I'll move on. The second question is the kind of occupation and skills. The court noted that both the CEO and independent contractor rely upon sensitive information that is provided or could be provided to either the chief executive officer or an independent contractor if the intent is to sell assets. Because the court found that it could be one or the other, under a summary judgment standard, the court is to presume it was through the capacity of the chief executive officer, not as an independent contractor. The possibility that a person employed as an independent contractor could perform those functions does not make it a probability under a summary judgment standard. But that's what the court below ruled. The third question is the cost of operations. The trial court found that Mr. Nagy did not maintain a separate workplace as an independent contractor would. So he ruled in favor of Mr. Nagy on that sum.
It doesn't matter what the court ruled below. This is de novo review.
Okay. But the point is that Mr. Nagy was not maintaining a separate business location to operate his independent contractor business.
He used his home.
He used his home, which was also the corporate office for Wells Venture Corporation. It was a registered office of the business.
He didn't work at the golf course.
They did not own the golf course anymore. There was no office there that he could have worked at. He worked at the only registered office the corporation had, the only office it had anywhere. But that was the legal address under the law of the state of Michigan for that company, and that's where he performed the services. The court also noted that Mr. Nagy did not seek reimbursements for a number of costs or that there was insufficient facts regarding the reimbursements. Again, that's a standard that would apply in favor of Mr. Nagy using the deferential analysis. The fourth factor is the method and form of payment. The problem that we have here is in the typical question of whether we have an employee or an independent contractor, there's two separate payment schemes available. Some people are being paid under a 1099, and others are being paid under a W-2. Here we have a single employee. The decision to pay as a 1099 rather than a W-2 is made solely for the benefit of the company. Mr. Nagy testified and proved through his tax records that he paid Social Security tax to the fullest amount required under the law and paid his Medicare taxes. There was no benefit to him. So, Your Honor, if there were two separate payroll systems available and a selection was made to pay Mr. Nagy under 1099, that would clearly favor that test in favor of the fund. But we don't have that fact here. We have a single option for one employee, and the benefit is to the corporation, not to him.
He also reported the income on a Schedule C.
Which legally is the only way he could have reported it once he received it under a 1099. And the question of job commitment and expectations, the fifth test. Mr. Nagy provided services to Wells Venture and to Nagy Ready Mix. Those are both companies that he had an ownership interest in.
That he had several jobs, doesn't that tip the balance, even if slightly, toward independent contractor?
It could under different circumstances, not under the facts of this case, Your Honor, because there is no question that Mr. Nagy was an employee of Nagy Ready Mix. So the fact that he has more than one job where they're both in companies that he's the owner of would not support that he's an employee in one and an independent contractor in the other. It would suggest the status is the same in both. But I don't think you can imply he's an independent contractor because he has one job with a company he owns where he's clearly and unequivocally an employee, and then suggest because he has that relationship, it's automatically independent contractor in another company which he also is an owner in.
Well, but wouldn't you agree that the more hours someone works exclusively for one company, the more that person looks like an employee?
Yes, I would agree with that. But there's no evidence in the record comparing the number of hours that he worked for WVC versus for Nagy Ready Mix. There's no testimony at all comparing the two.
Well, but there is testimony that his relationship with WVC, there's testimony that he says his relationship with WVC didn't change in 2005, but the number of hours he performed those services did.
True, yes.
And I think that number of hours can help to determine employee versus independent contractor status.
I would suggest it's more part-time employee versus full-time employee. An independent contractor could work full-time 40 or 50 hours a week. I see that frequently with trade representatives agreements where someone's representing an exclusive product arrangement. It doesn't necessarily have a direct correspondence.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. You've used your time, but I'm going to give you a minute for rebuttal. Mr. Lee. Hello.
Morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Charles Lee, and I represent the Appalachian Central States Pension Fund in this matter. I'll just jump right into the five-factor analysis on the independent contractor issue. The district court held in favor of the fund on this issue, and in doing so, it applied five-factor tests that this court has adopted in analyzing whether an individual is an independent contractor or employee. It found that three of the factors weighed in favor of the fund. And the first factor was the control and supervision issue. With respect to Mr. Robinson's argument that there was some oversight over Mr. Nagy by the board of directors, I'm just going to quote from his brief in the district court. And in that, he said he admitted that as the CEO, Mr. Nagy was the person with final operating control over corporate activities and thus had no one above him to direct his daily activities. So it's somewhat confusing for me for them to now argue that there was some evidence of that, that there was.
Is that a direct quote?
That is a direct quote, Your Honor. And it is cited in our appellate brief where we cite to the record as well. So, again, we would think, based on that admission, the control and supervision factor, we would argue, weighs heavily in favor of the fund. I'm going to jump to the method and form of payment, which is another issue that the district court held weighed in favor of the fund. It's undisputed that Mr. Nagy was a board member and a president of WVC from the 1990s to 2005. In 2005, a conscious decision was made by Mr. Nagy to pay himself as an independent contractor. He elected to be paid on a Form 1099, and he reported that on a Schedule C. Those things are commonly associated with being an independent contractor. Now, this is not the case of, like, Neiman, where in that case the individual argued that he received a 1099 in error and that the accountant reported the income on a Schedule C in error. In this case, Mr. Nagy testified and admitted that he consciously decided to receive a 1099 and report it on Schedule C because it spared him the burden and the company of doing payroll reporting. So if that decision was made by him, we think that that decision should stand. There's no reason for this court to go back and say, oh, really, it should have been as an employee or you should have received a W-2. With respect to the fifth factor in the analysis, the job commitment or expectations, as you, Judge Roldner, you correctly noted, he worked at his other companies. He was an employee for Nagy Ready Mix. He elected here, and then he also worked occasionally at WVC. I don't think it's disputed that his full-time job was with respect to Nagy Ready Mix.
Right. He's moonlighting as the CEO of this WVC company that once ran a golf course and a restaurant and at some point put the golf course out of business.
Right.
And consisted of just the restaurant. So essentially this is a second job for him.
We would agree with that, Your Honor. And the record shows that from the 1990s to 2005, and this is in his affidavit, he says that he occasionally and sporadically provided management services during that time period. But in 2005, when the decision was made to sell the golf course, the board of directors, which included himself, decided that the nature and the scope of his activities for the company would change. And therefore, they decided to pay him at that point and pay him as an independent contractor. What the district court picked up on was that this period where he's being paid as an independent contractor was for a specific and temporary purpose, with the idea that it would only last during the period when they were trying to negotiate the sale of the golf course, and therefore that he should be treated as an independent contractor on that factor.
Was the restaurant a going concern?
I believe that, too, was being sold with the company, but I'm not quite sure about that.
So it wasn't actually in operation during this time period?
I think that part was, Mr. Robin might be able to speak to it more clearly, but I believe that was part of the sale as well.
Didn't he work out of the WVC office until it was sold?
Yes, and from the night, I believe what he testified was that from the 1990s to 2005, he had an office there.
So why do you say he wasn't provided with office space?
After the sale of the golf course, Mr. Robinson was saying was that he didn't have an office there anymore after 2005, which we would argue tends to show that he wasn't an independent contractor, because if he is an employee, the company would provide him with office space.
So the restaurant is sold with the golf course. So what actually is he running?
He's not running anything. Well, he's doing some of the day-to-day management activities with the company trying to complete the sale of the assets. My understanding is that it took some period of time. During that period, he's also trying to sell some of the lots on the golf course. And then they ran into some problems, apparently pretty quickly, where the purchaser was not paying on the sale agreement. So then he had to retain counsel on behalf of the company to pursue default remedies, I guess.
So he's just divesting the assets at this point of the company?
I'm not sure if he's divesting the assets, but he's running. He's also selling the lots on the course as well to generate income for the company. But again, with respect to the restaurant issue, I think it's a little bit unclear for me. So maybe Mr. Robinson might be able to better address that.
He has an interesting question in his reply brief, and you haven't had a chance to respond. He could be an employee of Nagy Ready Mix and still serve WVC. Why couldn't he also be an employee of WVC and still serve Nagy Ready Mix? In other words, does his employee status at Nagy Ready Mix really have any bearing on anything?
Well, I think that if he had elected to be paid as an employee by WVC, certainly nothing under the IRS code would have prevented from doing that. But he decided in this case to pay himself on a Form 1099. And so he decided to be treated as an independent contractor for tax purposes. So he should be treated as one, we would argue. I would also like to address the standard on the independent contractor issue. I know, Judge Sykes, you mentioned several times that you thought that it was de novo review. My analysis of the case and the case law was that if the district court applied the five-factor test, then any factual determinations must be reviewed under the clearly erroneous standard. And so we would submit that the district court's determinations should be reviewed under...
This is here on cross motions for summary judgment?
That's correct, Your Honor.
It's de novo review.
Okay. I will move on to the leasing issue if there's no more questions about the independent contractor issue. The district court ruled against the fund on the leasing issue, and it did so without the benefit of having the SCOF BP decision decided. The defendants argued that SCOF BP was incorrectly decided because they argued that the Gretzinger test must be applied for every MEPA case. And we would argue that that's not the case. The Gretzinger test was adopted by this court because it determined that in certain instances where there were gray areas involving personal activities, hobbies, gambling, or maybe even consulting, that it needed a test to determine what should be a trade or business. And it decided that the Gretzinger test would be used. Now, in SCOF BP, this court determined that the purpose of MEPA is to prevent a company or entity from fractionalizing its assets and shifting assets. And it determined that leasing to the withdrawing employer is categorically a trade or business. And so it determined that leasing to the withdrawing employer is not one of those gray areas where it needs the Gretzinger test to determine what is a trade or business or not. I would submit that SCOF BP, Fulkerson, White can all be harmonized and read together. Fulkerson and White involve leasing by individuals to third parties. It did not involve leasing to the withdrawing company. And so those type of cases are gray areas. And I believe in the SCOF case, SCOF BP case, the court stated itself that those were rare cases. Those were difficult cases. But with respect to SCOF BP, where it was leasing to the withdrawing company, the court determined that it was not a gray area. It was something that it could decide per se, and it determined that from here on that leasing to the withdrawing employer should be categorically a trade or business. So we would ask that this court reject the district court's findings on the leasing issue and uphold the district court's determination on the independent contractor issue.
Why would we do that if you're right on the WBC aspect of the rule?
Excuse me?
Why would we do that if you're correct? Why would we need to do that if you're correct on the WBC part of the ruling?
Right, you're right. If you affirm the district court on the independent contractor issue, then you don't really even need to touch the SCOF BP issue.
All right.
If there's no further questions, I'll just wait the rest of my time.
Thank you so much. You have a question or two to respond to. 2 minutes.
Yes. Thank you. I'll start with the quote.
Did you?
No, I just wanted to check.
Oh, sure.
I will start with the quote that Mr. Lee gave regarding the lack of day-to-day supervision. That is an accurate quote. We don't contest that it is. The point being that as the chief executive officer of the company, whether you're an employee or an independent contractor, you would not have day-to-day supervision by anyone. So that standard is not relevant whether he had day-to-day supervision. It would be the same result as chief executive officer, employee, or chief executive officer independent contractor. The issue is whether there was a right to control. And the board of directors has the right to control the chief executive officer. It does not have the right to control an outside third party who comes in as an independent contractor, because the right to control Mr. Nagy's services was there. We believe that the first test should be in favor of Mr. Nagy. There was also a question by Judge Sykes as to whether the restaurant continued to be active. It was not. And one of our concerns with the whole WVC analysis is that, in retrospect, the factual record was not complete on many points. We did not have the guidance of the testimony of the board of directors. We did not have a complete analysis of the transaction. The fact of the matter is all of the assets were sold, and Mr. Nagy was simply, as Judge Sykes points out, in effect supervising the dissolution of the company and the collection of the funds in response to it.
So there is no payroll?
There was no payroll because there was a sole employee, and to establish a payroll system for just the president or chief executive officer of the company involves quite a bit of expense. And for the company's benefit, you could avoid that expense by paying him as a 1099. That's all they were doing, was
sounds
avoiding
like
that expense.
A decision to hire him as an independent contractor.
Well, but if it was a new hiring, I could understand that analysis, Your Honor. But what we had was a continuity of a relationship. The only testimony below was that the reason Mr. Nagy was being paid was solely because the amount of his hours were being increased. There's no testimony that the nature of the job he was performing impacted whether he was being paid or not. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. The case will be taken under advisement, and we will go on.